This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm TV critic David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. A lot of us have been sucked back into the O.J. Simpson trial and all that emotional anguish, confusion, and divisiveness that surrounded it when it was broadcast live on TV in 1995. That's thanks to the new FX anthology series American Crime Story and its season-long opening drama, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. It's based on the best-selling book about the trial by legal reporter and analyst Jeffrey Toobin. Our guest, Sarah Paulson, is giving an Emmy-worthy performance as prosecutor Marcia Clark. Clark was blamed by a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, for losing the case. She also was seen as a victim of rampant sexism in and out of the courtroom. The jury found Simpson not guilty of the double murder of his ex-wife Nicole Simpson and her friend Ron Goldman at Nicole's home. The O.J. series was created by Ryan Murphy, who also created the FX series American Horror Story. Sarah Paulson starred in several seasons of that series. She also co-starred in the movie Carol. She's been acting professionally since she was 19. Let's start with a scene from The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Here's Sarah Paulson as Marcia Clark making her opening argument at the trial.
We've watched O.J. Simpson win the Heisman Trophy. We've watched him in movies and commercials. We think we know him. But what we've been seeing is a public face. The face of the athlete, the actor. But like many public men, he also has a private side. The O.J. Simpson you've never met. The face of a batterer. The abuser, the murderer. I would like to summarize the results of our evidence from these heartless slayings. The blood trail at the Rockingham property matches the defendant. The blood found on the glove recovered at Rockingham matches the defendant. The blood drops at the Bundy murder scene match the defendant. And the blood found in the Bronco matches a mixture of the defendant, Ron Goldman, and Nicole Brown.
Sarah Paulson, welcome to Fresh Air. So you were 19 when the white Bronco chase was broadcast live on TV, starting the OJ fixation. How closely did you follow the trial?
Not very closely at all. I was a decidedly self-interested 19-year-old actress in New York City who was beginning my career, and I was very focused on that, and I just was not one of those people who became very, very obsessed and possessed by the trial.
Did you have any general impressions of Marcia Clark back then?
Oh, I did indeed. I drank the proverbial Kool-Aid about her, and didn't do any deep thinking to challenge what I was being told, and was very much on the Marcia Clark is a strident, shrew bitch person. I had sort of succumbed to that way of thinking.
And now, your impressions of her now after portraying her?
My impressions of her now after portraying her are incredibly, vastly different. As anyone's would be if they had taken the time to investigate a little bit about her. And I now hold her to be a very competent, complicated, strong, deep-thinking, quick-witted, quick-draw, wonderful creature person.
So how did you prepare to portray Marcia Clark? What did you read? What did you watch? What did you listen to?
I read, watched, and listened to any and everything I could get my hands on. The good news is there are copious amounts of videos on the internet where I was able to watch a lot of her physical, her carriage, the way she used her hands, the way she spoke, how she often tilted her head to one side, particularly in the courtroom when she was addressing the judge, the defense team, or the jury. I read her book. I read Darden's book. I read Toobin's book. And, of course, I read our scripts, which was probably where I ended up holding most closely that stuff.
I know you met her. Was that before, during, or after the shoot?
I met her after we shot episode 6, the Marsha episode. I did not meet her before then. And
that's this week's episode.
This week's episode was when I met her, after we were done shooting it.
So did meeting her change anything for you? And what did you most want to know from her?
You know, I don't even know that I wanted to know anything specific. I just wanted to breathe the same air that she was breathing in the same moment. I had so immersed myself in all things Marsha Rachel Clark that I just, the idea that I could be sitting across from her, and I'd come to revere her and respect her so enormously and to feel so much empathy and compassion that, as I said before, I never had for her. And I just kind of wanted to hug her. I wanted to look her in the eye and tell her that she didn't have to be fearful of the take that was going to be presented about her, given all that I knew she had endured. I could have only imagined that and anticipated that she was going to be terribly, terribly anxious about having to relive this experience that was a great trauma for her. She never went back into the courtroom to prosecute a case after this trial, and she had won 19 out of 20 prior to this case, so it was obviously a great passion of hers, and it was stolen from her. So I don't know that I took anything away from it or expected anything other than I just wanted to be in her orbit.
The O.J. Simpson trial was so much about how race and gender influence people's perceptions. Was O.J. a wife abuser who then murdered her out of jealousy? Are police racist? Was there a racist conspiracy against O.J.? And I think in a lot of people's minds, there was no room for two things to be true, for to be true that O.J. was a wife abuser and a murderer, and for there to be some racism among police. Were you afraid almost of like stepping back into this controversy and by virtue of playing Marsha Clark, kind of inserting yourself into the middle of it?
Truthfully, I was more terrified about whether or not I was going to be able to pull this off. My fear sort of really lived there. I don't really feel that we've come that far from that period in our country's history. So it didn't really feel like it was an enormous step back in a way to me. But I know I was terribly afraid I was going to fail quite miserably doing this.
Why? I mean, do you always feel that way when you take on a role?
I do always feel that way. I'm an incredibly self-critical kind of person and therefore actress, which is why I haven't even watched any of this yet. I think anytime you're playing someone that is a real person, and certainly someone that has a kind of iconic place in the country's memory, I felt if I get this wrong, it's going to be very clear that I've gotten it wrong, and it's going to be a very sort of epic public failure. And the more I read about her, the more I knew about her, the more I just wanted to get it right. And that was my primary concern, was just to get it right. And by right, I mean just for it to be authentic and truthful. And I wasn't really looking at it as a way of trying to correct any perception or misconception about Marsha. I just wanted to try to do it in an honorable and a truthful way.
So there's a scene based on a scene that actually happened in which she had asked Judge Ito not to extend the time of the trial that day because she had to take care of her children. She was due back at home. She was going through divorce proceedings at the time. Custody was an issue, and she needed to be home and, you know, do her job as a mother. And so the next day when the court convened and Judge Ito started to ask the defense to call their witness, and there's a whole backstory to the witness, Johnny Cochran made a kind of catty remark about the daycare, and Marsha Clark responded. So let's just hear that scene.
Okay.
It starts with Judge Ito.
Mr. Cochran, is Ms. Lopez present here today?
She is, Your Honor.
And do you anticipate that we can hear what she has to say in one day?
I would expect so, Your Honor, barring any acts of God or further child care crises from Ms. Clark.
Your Honor, I am offended by Mr. Cochran's remarks as a woman and as a mother. Mr. Cochran may not know what it's like to work a 70-hour work week and also take care of a family, but I do. And many other people do, too. To belittle my child care issues in your courtroom is unconscionable and totally out of line.
So that was Kenneth Choi as Judge Ito, Courtney Vance as Johnny Cochran, and my guest, Sarah Paulson, as Marsha Clark. So, Sarah Paulson, did
That makes me so upset.
Did you go back and watch that part of the actual court case?
I did. That was actually one of the more difficult days I had. I can't even hear it, even just now, without getting angry, and my throat starts to close up. I just, I cannot believe that Cochran would stoop. I mean, I can, but just on Marsha's behalf, I just cannot believe that that was something that she had to do and stand up in that courtroom and defend her need to be home with her child. It chaps my ass, I have to say, if you can say things like that on the radio.
When you watched Marsha Clark say more or less those words, what did you try to pick up on from how she said it and what you saw going on her face?
Well, I could tell that she was very upset and that she was sitting on a lot of things she probably would like to be saying. She was just desperately trying, I think, to not spit nails, and was very angry, and at the same time did not want to be labeled hysterical. So she was sitting on it, and so those are the things I saw.
You said that you could see that Marsha Clark had all these like emotions and anger, but she was just sitting on it. You know, she was like containing it, but it was coming out anyways. There's a scene in this week's episode where it all kind of comes out. Like after she's had this makeover because she's supposed to look more feminine, and then people mock her for that. And after her first husband has given a tabloid a naked photo of them that's published that totally humiliates her. And after this incident with Johnny Cochran, she just kind of loses it. She loses it in the courtroom, and then afterwards she's alone in her office sitting on the floor just weeping when Chris Darden from the prosecution team walks in. And he sits down next to her. And I want to play that scene. So Marsha Clark is on the floor weeping, and here's what she tells Darden.
I'm not a public personality. This isn't what I do. I don't know how to do this. And those other guys, they're flashy hotshots. They're used to it. But I just can't take it.
You'll do fine.
No, I won't.
Yeah. I know it. And if it helps him, you do look mighty good in that picture.
It's my guest Sarah Paulson as Marsha Clark with Sterling K. Brown as Chris Darden. You know what I relate to about that scene? I think so many working women worry about the possibility of crying on the job. Because I think it's probably true that women cry a little more easily than men. not to play into stereotype, but I think that's probably true.
It's probably true.
And you just don't want to have to cry on the job, no matter how bad you're feeling. It just always feels a little embarrassing, whether it should or shouldn't, it does.
Absolutely.
And in that scene, you're crying alone in your office until Chris Darden walks in. So you never had the opportunity to see what Marsha Clark looks like when she's crying and alone.
No, I didn't.
So you had to figure that out for yourself.
I sure
did. So what kind of crier did you decide she was going to be?
I don't think I decided anything. I think I just, played the scene and looked at Sterling, whom I think is just such an extraordinary actor, and we had such a wonderful, intimate connection that we were able to draw upon, which was so wonderful. There was something sort of raw about this and something that I just sort of let come. I mean, it sort of happened in the courtroom, too, when I walk in with my haircut. Again, I had nothing planned, and there was nothing scripted about what was to happen or not to happen, but Ryan Murphy, who directed this episode, just said to me, I want you to walk in and I want you to be ready for the day. You've got this. And I think you look pretty good, and you're just here to do your job. And I walked in that courtroom, and wasn't really thinking about how to play any of it, and Ito looks over at Marcia and says, "Welcome, Miss Clark, I think." There's a smattering, tittering laughter that happens. She looks to the left, and there's, you know, all those men sit. And it's just was the most humiliating thing. I felt so embarrassed. The temperature in my face and my neck rose. I could feel my pulse in my cheeks. And I just, it was very, very hard for me to keep it together. And I was a bit of a mess. And, you know, there's nothing sort of more uncomfortable and also sort of exciting as an actor to sort of feel that you are out of control in a way, and that I wasn't trying to
out of control in character.
In control in character, yeah, that you're going to control the moment. Oh, you're going to laugh here, or sometimes it's scripted, laugh here, she cries here. And sometimes when you don't have those guidelines, it's kind of freeing, because you just, if you're working with a director, and I was this time with Ryan, that trusts you and that, you know, lets you sort of trust yourself, and it just came out.
So American Crime Story, which the O.J. series is part of, was created by Ryan Murphy, who also created American Horror Story, and you've been in several seasons of that. One of the roles that you played was a conjoined twin who has two heads. So she has one body, two heads, two brains. So
two brains.
Each of these people, each of the two women sharing this body, have different feelings, different emotions.
Yes, and, different feelings, different emotions.
And they are put in a freak show. Can we just talk technically for a second? Like,
please.
How exactly was this done? This two-headed person.
If I really explained it really intricately in full detail, you'd probably fall asleep before I finish. But essentially, it was all done on a green screen. And I would come in the morning and pre-record my dialogue, because often the twins were speaking telepathically to one another, and I wanted to be able to hear my own voice in my head. So I would record it and then wear an earwig so that I could talk to myself. I didn't want to have another actress off camera reading that didn't sound like me and didn't sound like my twin. It was a lot of lonely work where I would have to look at a piece of tape and imagine my own head there. I never was able to look in anyone else's eyes to play a scene with myself in the way that I had to. It was incredibly challenging and very, very technical. And everyone who ever did a scene with me on that season of Horror Story was just always bemoaning the fact that they had to work with me, because it meant their day was infinitely longer, because it was just take after take. And, you know, we essentially had to do everything twice. Each of the twins had to have their own, you know. And I would have to go back and forth between each girl. They would shoot a big wide shot, and then they would do a tighter shot, and then I would have to switch characters before they could change the lens to go in tighter. And so it was really, really hard to do. It really was.
Because sexual orientation is still a thing in our culture, you made news when you kissed Cherry Jones at the Tony Awards in 2005 when she won, because you were there together as a couple. Did you realize that you'd be on camera and that that would be reported and that it would mean that you were in the public eye as a couple?
I think I was a bit naive, actually, as to what it would mean. I was just doing what was instinctual to me, which was to congratulate and kiss the person whom I loved and who had just won a very sort of fancy acting prize. And it would have been strange for me to, what, you know, I don't know, pat her on the head or pat her on the shoulder. And I just sort of did what occurred to me to do. But I was very quickly made aware of it being a bit of a news, because I got a phone call from my publicist saying, "Why did you do that?" She's no longer my publicist, though, by the way.
Because of that?
Well, I remember feeling sort of like I was getting my hand slapped, that I had done something wrong. And I didn't feel very comfortable with that. It wasn't immediately after that that I severed that relationship, but not my relationship with Cherry, but the relationship with the publicist.
So you had already had, you know, years of being a professional actress before you were in a couple with another woman, because you'd been with men before that. So did it change, do you think, how you were treated professionally? I mean, your career actually has gotten a lot bigger since then.
Yeah, I don't think I felt it in any substantial way that it was a hindrance for me. But then again, I had been working, but I wasn't very well known, and I just didn't feel it. I didn't feel it, and certainly I wonder sometimes if being in the Ryan Murphy world, and that I get to play so many different types of characters within that one TV show, mm-hmm. that there really isn't time to sort of typecast me as one particular kind of thing. I'm not a sex symbol. I'm not a, what is like a person in a
your
comic
typical
book
movie star
figure. You're sort of typical. Yeah, I'm not sort of your typical movie star. And I don't, so I wonder if I've been sort of protected from having to worry about it preventing me from working in a way, because the public doesn't really have a particular attachment to me being one type of thing.
Right. And also, you know? Ryan Murphy's gay, and I think there's more and more people in Hollywood and Broadway coming out, so it's hopefully not as big a thing as it would have been.
Here's
hoping, right. So, yeah. So I don't know if I'm crossing a line here, so guide me. You're in a relationship now with the actress Holland Taylor. Holland Taylor's about 30 years older than you. And I know people who've been through this. When your partner deals with the health-related issues of aging far in advance than you deal with it, you know, it's something people face. And have you kind of like jumped ahead to that, or you're not thinking about that, or is that irrelevant?
I would have to be.
Or is that none of my business? Just tell me.
It's not none of your business. I think it's a sort of interesting, one of the more interesting questions that I've been asked about this. So I'm actually happy to answer it. I have thought about it. I think I would be a strange person if I didn't, because how could I not? There is a very significant age difference, and when you love a person, the idea of losing them is sort of terrifying, to put it mildly. Yeah. So I have thought about it. But, you know, Holland actually put the best spin on it and said what I think was a sort of very, very funny thing, which is we were at a dinner party and we were newly sort of out and about as a couple, and a mutual friend of ours said, "Oh, Holland, I am so, so pleased for you. I'm so happy. This is so great, you and Sarah." And Holland said, "Yeah, I know. You know, look, if she dies, she dies." And it was just so, it was so sort of disarming, because, you know, and Holland's point being, you know, yes, on paper, it looks like one thing, but anything can happen and you just don't know. So, you know, but of course it's something I think about, because that would be very upsetting. And of course, on paper, seems a lot closer than it normally would in a relationship. So, but it's something I don't like to think about often. So thanks for asking, Terry. No, I'm just kidding. Thanks for bringing it up towards the end of the interview so I can go off and cry somewhere. Privately, by the way.
Right. Are you going to cry like you or like Marcia Clark?
I'm going to cry like me or maybe like Marcia Clark.
So you said you don't like watching your own work because you're very self-critical. You haven't watched any of the OJ series. Are you ever going to watch it?
I am going to watch it, but I think I'm going to wait till it's over, until all the sort of hoopla dupla doo has died down about it. I think it's the first time in my life I have felt, in my professional life, I have felt a real swell of positive feeling about my work in something. And I think I'm trying to just enjoy that, because I know that if I watch it, I'm going to start picking it apart. And I think it would be nice, a nice treat for myself, to give myself a minute of enjoyment to celebrate, you know, the work. And I know I was certainly very proud to do it, and I had a very strong emotional connection to the material and to the person. But I'm trying to enjoy what seems to be a positive reaction to my work in it, and I don't want to sully it by ripping it apart. So I'm trying to give myself a little time.
Sarah Paulson, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much, and I'm really enjoying your performance.
Thank you so much. It means a lot to me. Thank you.
Actress Sarah Paulson spoke with Terry last Thursday. Paulson co-stars in the FX American crime story dramatization, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Our critic at large, John Powers, has a review of a new graphic novel that he describes as an astonishing work of imagination. It's by the Singaporean writer and illustrator Sunny Liu, who was born in Malaysia, studied philosophy at Cambridge University, and is best known in the U.S. for his acclaimed DC Comics series Dr. Fate, about an Egyptian-American superhero. His new graphic novel, his biggest and most ambitious work, spans decades. Here's John's review of The Art of Charlie Chan Hock Chai.
It wasn't so long ago that comics were considered artistically marginal. Pure adolescent fantasy. All that changed with the 1986 release of Mouse, Art Spiegelman's graphic novel, as they're now called, that tackled the Holocaust and its effect on his family. Mouse won a Pulitzer Prize and unleashed the ongoing wave of masterful books that includes Alan Moore's Watchmen, Chris Ware's Jimmy Corrigan, and Alison Bechdel's Fun Home. Grappling with everything from sex and politics to violence and alienation, these comics took you places you hadn't gone before. That happens again in The Art of Charlie Chan Hock Chai, a startlingly brilliant tour de force by the Singapore artist and writer Sunny Liu. Although the premise sounds simple, it's the biography of a fictional comic book artist. What Liu does with it is anything but. At once dizzyingly meta and deeply heartfelt, the book spans 80 years, and in its complicated layering reminded me of everything from Mouse and the Tin Drum to, believe it or not, Ulysses. The book's hero is Chan Hock Chai. His English language name, in a little joke, is Charlie. Chan is born in 1938 Singapore, and from the beginning, this shopkeeper's son loves to draw. When he first discovers comic books at the local library, he's forever smitten. He dedicates his whole life to making them, becoming a monk of the craft. Never married, he turns down commercial jobs to spend decades creating comics that don't make money. But while Chan personally leads a quiet, almost invisible existence, his career is shot through with the great drama of history. He lives through the epic transformation of his tiny island home from a third-world outpost of the British Empire to a sleek country often called the Switzerland of Asia. Clean, orderly, and so prosperous that its per capita GDP is 1.5 times our own. Over the years, Chan experiences the Japanese invasion of World War II, Singapore's messy struggle for independence, and the eventual emergence of a seemingly all-powerful ruling party. He watches this skillfully run, if sometimes repressive, state become a safe haven where billionaires move to stash their cash. Now, Liu doesn't present this transformation so baldly. We watch it happen by reading the comics that Chan supposedly creates about these events. Of course, Liu himself creates them all, both naive and sophisticated, with dazzling virtuosity. Man, can this guy draw. Giving us a grand tour of comic book history, he works in styles that reference everything from Britain's The Beano and Japanese manga to Mad Magazine, Pogo, Spider-Man, even Scrooge McDuck. Every page hums with visual invention, including those pages in which Liu himself turns up, a bespectacled little dude, to comment on the action. Although The Art of Charlie Chan Hock Chai is probably the greatest work of art ever produced in Singapore, the book was controversial there. It's not a country big on dissent, and Liu points out the cracks in the official myths erected by the party that's ruled for the last half century. Yet at the same time, he hasn't written a subversive tract or poisoned pen letter. Even as he regrets the country's missed opportunities, the book is filled with affection, even love. It's a valentine to cartooning, to old buildings and street food, to heroes written out of official history, to ordinary people trying to make a better life. Most moving and most universal is Liu's portrait of the artist as a young, middle-aged, and old man. By today's standards, Chan would be considered a failure. His work doesn't sell, his apartment is modest, and as the country around him grows richer and glossier, he lives in obscurity, all alone, creating comics about a success-mad culture that ignores him. Near the end, the aging Chan jets to San Diego to attend Comic-Con, in hopes of finding kindred spirits and maybe landing some work. The trip doesn't pan out. Yet he doesn't let this disappointment stop him. Back home, surrounded by his pens and ink bottle, he keeps doing what he's always done, pursuing his art in the face of a world that doesn't seem to want it. You see, Chan would rather remain marginal forever than give up doing what he cares about most. And Liu makes it heartbreakingly clear that such devotion is one of the highest forms of grace.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed The Art of Charlie Chan Hock Chai by Sunny Liu. One of the worst Supreme Court decisions in history was the 1927 decision upholding a state's right to forcibly sterilize a person considered unfit to procreate. Unfit because they were deemed to be an imbecile. At least our guest, journalist Adam Cohen, considers this one of the court's worst decisions. That decision is part of a larger chapter of American history in which the eugenics movement aimed to prevent so-called mentally deficient people from procreating. Through not allowing them to marry, sterilizing them, and segregating them in special colonies. The Nazis borrowed some ideas from American eugenicists. The eugenics movement also influenced the 1924 Immigration Act, which was designed, in part, to keep out Italians and Eastern European Jews. Adam Cohen's new book, Imbeciles, is about the eugenics movement in the early 20th century and the Supreme Court case legalizing sterilization. Cohen is a former member of the New York Times editorial board and a former senior writer for Time magazine. He spoke with Terry Gross last Monday.
Adam Cohen, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with what the eugenicists believed.
They embraced the new genetics that was emerging in their era, and they believed that it could be used to perfect the human race. The word eugenics was actually coined by Francis Galton, who was a half-cousin of Charles Darwin, and it really derived a lot from Darwinian ideas. The eugenicists looked at evolution and survival of the fittest as Darwin was describing it, and they believed we can help nature along if we just plan who reproduces and who doesn't reproduce.
And who was considered unworthy of reproducing?
At the beginning, Galton looked at geniuses throughout history and looked to see if genius was genetic within families, and he believed that it was. But over time, eugenics expanded quite a bit, and by the time it got to America, there were all kinds of categories of people who were deemed to be unfit, including people who were deaf, blind, diseased. Poor was a big category. So it was really in the eye of the beholder. People looked around and they saw human qualities they didn't like, and they thought, we can really breed these out.
And you left out feeble-minded. What did feeble-minded mean?
Yes, feeble-minded was really the craze in American eugenics. There was this idea that we were being drowned in a tide of feeble-mindedness, that basically unintelligent people were taking over, reproducing more quickly than the intelligent people. But it was also a very malleable term that was used to define large categories of people that, again, were disliked by someone who was in the decision-making position. So women who were thought to be overly interested in sex, licentious, sometimes deemed feeble-minded. It was a broad category, and it was very hard to prove at one of these feeble-mindedness hearings that you were not feeble-minded.
In this campaign season, when immigration is such a contested issue, it's very interesting to learn, because I didn't know this, that the immigration law of 1924 is connected to the eugenics movement. What was the law, and how is it connected to eugenics?
Yeah, so the 1924 law really changed American immigration dramatically. Whereas in the old days, people would pretty much just show up at Ellis Island. The people who supported the Immigration Act of 1924 wanted to maintain the racial composition of the United States. So they imposed national quotas, which actually set the immigration from different countries on what that country's percentage of the population was in 1890. And the idea was that was a time when there were a lot of, you know, so-called Nordics in the United States. So by imposing these national quotas, more people would come in from places like England, and fewer would come in from Eastern Europe and Italy. And a big concern was for these folks, the immigration of particularly Eastern European Jews and Italians. And the degree to which eugenics was just squarely in the discussion of the act was rather shocking. One of the villains of my book, Harry Laughlin, not only testified repeatedly about eugenics while Congress was considering the law, but he was actually appointed expert eugenics agent by Congress. And when I was looking through his papers in Missouri, there was letterhead. The U.S. Immigration Committee said Harry Laughlin, expert eugenics agent. Kind of chilling.
So the immigration law of 1924, which, should we say, limited or prevented Jews and Italians from immigrating?
Limited extremely. So there were some, but the numbers fell so dramatically.
Okay, so that law was passed just in time for the Holocaust. So how did that come into play? And therefore, how did eugenics come into play in preventing Jews from seeking safe haven in the U.S. during the Holocaust?
It absolutely did prevent many Jews from coming to America at the time. Under the old immigration laws, where it was pretty much, you know, show up, they would have been able to emigrate. But suddenly they were, you know, trapped by very unfavorable national quotas. So this really was a reason that so many Jews were turned away. And one very poignant aspect of it that I thought about as I was working on the book is in the late 90s, some correspondence appeared, was uncovered, in which Otto Frank was writing repeatedly to the State Department begging for visas for himself and his wife and his two daughters, Margot and Anne, and was turned down. And that was because there were now these quotas in place. And if they had not been, it seems clear that he would have been able to get a visa for his whole family, including his daughter, Anne Frank. So when we think about the fact that Anne Frank died in a concentration camp, we're often told that it was because the Nazis believed that Jews were genetically inferior, that they were lesser than Aryans. That's true, but to some extent, Anne Frank died in a concentration camp because the U.S. Congress believed that as well.
That's just chilling. So in talking about that 1924 immigration law, were Asians included too?
Yeah, well, the national quota excluded too. Yeah, well, the national quota did not work out well for them because there were so few around in 1890. And on the West Coast, it was actually a big issue. So Asians were another target.
So the eugenicists were partly behind the 1924 immigration law. There were laws that prevented people from marrying if they were deemed hereditarily unworthy. There were laws that allowed people considered feeble-minded to be isolated in institutions in the U.S. What was the logic behind institutionalizing people who were deemed feeble-minded?
Well, the eugenicists saw two threats to the national gene pool. One was the external one, which they were addressing through immigration law. The other was the internal one, what to do about the people who were already here. And they had a few ideas. The first eugenics law in the United States was passed in Connecticut in 1895, and it was a law against certain kinds of marriages. They were trying to stop certain unfit people from reproducing through marriage. It wasn't really what they wanted, though, because they realized that people would just reproduce outside of marriage. So their next idea was what they called segregation. The idea was to get people who were deemed unfit institutionalized during their reproductive years, particularly for women, keep them there, make sure that they didn't reproduce. And then women were often let go when they had passed their reproductive years because they were no longer a threat to the gene pool. That had a problem too, though. And the problem was that it would be really expensive to segregate, institutionalize the number of people the eugenicists were worried about. One of my villains in the book, Harry Laughlin, gave a major address in which he said that to get rid of the, you know, the one-tenth of the country that he was worried about, as many as 15 million people would have to be sterilized. So you couldn't put 15 million people in institutions. They understood that it just wasn't economically feasible. So their next idea was eugenic sterilization. And that allowed for a model in which they would take people into institutions, eugenically sterilize them, and then they could let them go because they were no longer a threat. So that's why eugenic sterilization really became the main model that the eugenicists embraced and that many states enacted laws to allow.
And this was involuntary sterilization. What were the techniques that were used to sterilize men or women?
For men, it was something like a vasectomy. For women, it was a salpingectomy, where they cauterized the path that the egg takes towards fertilization. It was, in the case of women, particularly, not minor surgery. And when you add on to all that, the fact that in many, many cases, the women involved were not told what was being done to them. They might be told that they were having an appendectomy or, you know, they weren't being told that the government has decided that you are unfit to reproduce and we're then going to have surgery on you.
Carrie Buck was chosen to be the subject for a test case for a Virginia law allowing forced sterilization of people considered feeble-minded. And that case made it to the Supreme Court. It's this case that's the main focus of your book, and it resulted in a decision that allowed states to forcibly sterilize people deemed feeble-minded. Carrie Buck was at the time an inmate, I think is the right word, an inmate of the Colony for Epileptics and the Feeble-Minded. What was this colony, and why were epileptics and the, quote, feeble-minded pulled together?
Well, it started as an epileptic colony, and a few years they expanded it to add feeble-minded because they had so many people who were being designated feeble-minded and they didn't really have a great place to put them all, and a lot of the hospitals were getting crowded. And at the time, there was this idea that for both epileptics and the feeble-minded, if you put them out in the country in a farm-like setting, gave them chores, that the fresh air would help with their recovery, although really no one was recovering.
So why was Carrie Buck in this institution?
Well, it's a terribly sad story. She was a little girl who was being raised by a single mother in poverty in Charlottesville, sometimes on the streets of Charlottesville. She got taken in by a foster family that wanted to help her to a better life, or so it seemed, but they actually made her do all the work, and she wasn't allowed to call her foster parents mother and father. And then eventually she's raped by a nephew of the family and is pregnant out of wedlock. At the time, that was a huge scandal in and of itself. And then when you add in the fact that if the facts came to light, their nephew could be prosecuted for a very serious crime, the foster family decided to have a feeble-mindedness hearing for Carrie Buck and to testify that she was actually, they said, both epileptic and feeble-minded. Although, you know, total lies. She was not epileptic and never had a seizure, and everyone sort of agreed towards the end of her life that she'd never been epileptic. She also wasn't feeble-minded. She was doing well in school, and there's a little hearing. She's declared feeble-minded, and she gets sent off to the colony for epileptics and feeble-minded, where, as it happens, her mother, who probably was also not feeble-minded, was already an inmate.
So Carrie Buck is sent to this colony for epileptics and the feeble-minded. And I guess after she gives birth, because she's pregnant during her hearing, she gives birth, she's sterilized.
Yes. When she's at the colony, the guy who's running the colony, Dr. Albert Priddy, is on the prowl. He's looking for someone to put at the center of this test case that they want to bring. So he's looking for someone to sterilize. And he sees Carrie Buck when she comes in. He does the examination himself. And there are a lot of things about her that excite him. She's deemed to be feeble-minded. She has a mother who's feeble-minded, so that's good because you can show some genetics. And then they're hoping that the baby could be determined to be feeble-minded, too. Then you could really show a genetic pattern of feeble-mindedness. The fact that she had been pregnant out of wedlock was another strike against her. So he fixes on her and thinks Carrie Buck is going to be the perfect potential plaintiff. So he chooses her, and then under the Virginia law, they have to have a sterilization hearing at the colony, which they do. And they give her a lawyer who is really not a lawyer for her. It's really someone who had been the chairman of the board of the colony and was sympathetic to the colony side. And they have a bit of a sham hearing where she's determined to be a suitable person for sterilization. They vote to sterilize her. And that is the order that then gets challenged by Carrie as the plaintiff, first in the Virginia court system and then in the Supreme Court.
So Carrie Buck loses the case in the Supreme Court. The court upholds Virginia's right to sterilize her. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, who I think was considered a progressive, writes the decision upholding forced sterilization. So what did he write in his majority decision?
You know, it was a very short decision, just about, you know, five paragraphs, but he packed in so many horrible ideas and misinformation that it was quite impressive. He had this famous phrase that is reverberated over the generations, three generations of imbeciles are enough. And by that, he meant Carrie Buck's mother, Carrie Buck, and Carrie Buck's daughter. And a somewhat pedantic point, but, you know, there were actually very precise categories of mental defect at that time. And the lowest category was idiot, the middle level was imbecile, and the highest level was moron. Carrie and her mother were both determined by the colony after extensive, you know, unreliable testing to be morons. But Oliver Wendell Holmes actually, you know, demoted them in his decision and called them imbeciles, which was a lower category.
So, you know, a lot of people just throw around words like imbecile and moron as like colorful ways of saying, God, that was such a stupid thing to do. What an imbecile. Or, oh, you behaved like such a moron. But I had no idea that those words had actually been official categories that were used to punish people and sterilize them.
They were. And, you know, beyond that terrible phrase, and it was terrible, what was really shocking about the decision is that rather than just decide the case before them, which is what the Supreme Court is supposed to do, and which Oliver Wendell Holmes, as a matter of his own judicial philosophy, he did believe in just narrowly ruling on the case before him, not having broad edicts. In this one case, he writes not only that Carrie Buck should be sterilized, that the Virginia law is constitutional, but he urges America to do more eugenic sterilization. And he has this terrible passage where he says, it is better for all the world if, instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. So at a time when we're hoping that maybe there'll be some incipient grassroots opposition to eugenics and opposition to these terrible eugenic sterilization laws, the U.S. Supreme Court, by an 8-1 vote, by the pen of the great Oliver Wendell Holmes, is saying, no, no, do more of this. Pass more laws. Sterilize more people. The nation needs it.
I don't know. I'm speechless. You consider that decision one of the worst Supreme Court decisions ever. You acknowledge there's a lot of competition for that, but why do you consider this one of the worst?
Well, about 70,000 Americans were sterilized as a result of this decision. Beyond the human effect, though, when you think about what we want the Supreme Court to be, what the founders wanted the Supreme Court to be, it was supposed to be the place that people could go when all the other parts of our society, all the other parts of the government were not treating them right. So Carrie Buck, this poor woman who has been raped, who has been wrongly designated feeble-minded, who has had her baby taken from her, who is being held as a prisoner in this horrible colony, goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. And we all know what the court should have done. Not only did it not do it, but the contempt that just dripped from this decision, three generations of imbeciles are enough. It's better for all the world, you know, if we sterilize more of these people. It just was a level of ugliness that I'm not sure we've really seen often in the Supreme Court.
Adam Cohen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Adam Cohen, speaking with Terry Gross last Monday. Cohen's new book is called Imbeciles. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challener. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inglewood.